I'm your host, Adam P. Kennedy. Welcome to America's Place in the World, featuring retired four-star United States Marine Corps General and former U.S. Special Envoy to Israel and the Palestinian Authority, Tony Zinni. We're looking at the world and America's place in it. In this episode, we're continuing our discussion on the Middle East, on this show, the United Arab Emirates and Afghanistan. It's coming up right now.
You never asked about UAE?
I'm coming there. I was saving the best for last. United Arab Emirates.
Very strong leader. I mean, technically, Khalifa is the older brother. Is the president of UAE and the emir of Abu Dhabi, but he is very ill, cancer. So basically, MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed, runs things. He's the crown prince. The other strong emirate there is Dubai. And so they have a lot of say. Technically, the emir in Dubai is the minister of defense, although MBZ runs the military. The other emirates are small. I mean, it's Dubai and Abu Dhabi are the big guns. A lot of wealth. MBZ is a very serious guy. I think he's very much a patriot. I mean, he loves his country, well trained by his father. I think it's a very efficient government. It's really not, there's no corruption or problems like that. I don't think they want to, you know, they want to be a player on the global scene, but I think they want to do it in a way that's viewed as positive, and they aren't trying to do splashy things as such. Sometimes they do things in a way that, you know, we would not agree with what they do, but I don't think you can question their motivation. You know, they're a little guy with a lot of money in a really tough world with a lot of big people around them. They've created this alliance with Saudi Arabia that's very strong. I mean, some people even consider them the senior partner in that relationship, despite the size differential because of MBZ's influence. They're very much want a special relationship with us. That's very important to them. They want to be seen as a serious country. I mean, they have no ambitions really other than being seen as, although small, very rich and very influential, as I think the way they see it. They want to be a big player in regional decisions and things that go on. They tend to understand the limitations on an energy-based economy. They've done a very good job of diversifying. Like Dubai has become a major banking center and commercial industry, and they've reached out and made investments in ways that will sustain them beyond the energy side. They've supported some things in the region. Some have been good decisions, some of them probably not good. You know, probably going to Yemen with Saudis was not a good decision for them. I said they have a very strong military, probably in terms of quality, the best in the region. But, you know, it's small, but again, get the reputation of little Sparta. I think MBZ personally has a lot of influence. He has a lot of respect around the senior leaders in Europe and around the world on a personal basis. I think he pushes more for some sort of cohesive, regional, responsible, capable structure than maybe any of the others do. And he'll be viewed as probably the most important leader in the region for a while, just from our perspective in terms of allies in the region.
Many of the gentlemen that you've mentioned, you know most of these individuals, is that correct?
Yep.
So tell me about MBZ. You had a relationship with his father.
I knew his father, but not as well as I knew him. Okay. I've known him now for 27 years, something like that.
Okay. And his ascendancy to power has come over the last, how long, sir?
Well, he was not the oldest son.
Right.
He was the oldest son of the favorite wife, Sheikha Fatima. But Sheikh Zayed, his father, had an older wife, a first wife, and there were two sons, I think, by that marriage, and the oldest one was Khalifa. But MBZ was always seen as the most powerful and up-and-coming guy, and maybe even considered a favorite of the father. So there was some talk when the father was on his last legs that maybe he would bypass Khalifa, which would have caused a lot of friction. But his father, as I understand it, called them both in and said, we're going to play by the rules. Khalifa will be the emir. But instead of Khalifa's, say, brother being the crown prince, Sheikh Mohammed would be the crown prince. And Mohammed accepted that. You know, he didn't want any friction or problem. Well, Khalifa was probably not as maybe recognized as the same kind of leadership as Mbz. And then Khalifa got very ill, been ill for a long time. So basically, he's been out of leadership role, and a lot of has been passed to Mbz. But Mbz is very conscious of all this. He is very respectful of his brother. Since Dubai was the second biggest or probably co-equal emirate and very rich and all, Mohammed bin Rashid, who's the emir there, is highly respected in the structure of the UAE. Nominally, a Khalifa is the president. It's always the emir of Abu Dhabi. And then Mohammed bin Rashid is sort of the number two, Secretary of Defense. But he really is not interested in the military. He really passed that all to Mbz. But Mbz still recognizes him and such and treats him that way. So he's been very careful, unlike MBS, you know, what he did to the royal family and everything. He's been very careful to keep the structure in place and being respectful of that, although everybody fully recognizes he's the power in the UAE. And he doesn't interfere with the other emirates and what they do in their own world. A lot of the smaller emirates have sort of specialized. One of the emirates, like Sharjah, is they have universities, several universities there, built relationships with the U.S. And even though they're small, they're very much, he treats them respectfully and manages the internal stuff very well and tries to stay away from, you know, I've watched him at majlises and diwaniyas, and he's very respectful of tribal leaders and elders. And one person described it to me. I said, you know, he's got a lot of respect here. And they said, we've watched him grow up since he was a little kid, and he's done all the right things internally of the tribal structure, the respect and all, and he became known. So they feel very comfortable with him as a leader because they say, we know him. We know him since he was growing up. He was not like a, you know, a wealthy guy removed from the people in the tribes. He's known by them who they are, and he interacts with them very effectively.
So how would you describe him then as, well, you mentioned as a leader?
I think he's very intelligent. I think he's a guy that constantly wants to learn. He's an exceptional listener, which I didn't find in some of the places out there. But if you say something to him, even though he disagrees with it, he always wants your advice. He's always asking opinions and advice. Not necessarily he's going to take it on board. He likes doing business one-on-one, which is not all of them like doing that. So he's liable to, the last time I was out there was at the hotel, and somebody came running in and said, there's the royal helicopter's out there. Sheikh Mohammed wants you into the helicopter to go see him at his farm at Al Ain. And I had to run out, jump in the helicopter, fly out to his farm and sit with him. He had the tribal leaders there for a big majlis and sit next to him as all the guys came up there. They kiss your nose and do all that stuff. And you know, we're going back and forth in this, and he had about five former prime ministers there. Tony Blair, not there, but at the same time visiting Tony Blair, David Cameron, the last French prime minister, and Australian, Italian, and Chinese, at a private little session discussing world things. He said to me, "Come with me. I want you to sit in on this," which was really heady stuff, you know. But he's very serious about that. He really engages. He wants to understand global issues, curious mind, takes all advice on board, not necessarily will agree with it, but is open to it. Yeah. I think in some ways people discount him and he gets, you know, like another rich Arab sheikh, but I think he's very different. I didn't agree with everything he's done, and I've said that to him, and we have that kind of friendship. We could be candid to each other, but I never would doubt his intent, which is the best interest of his people.
How would you describe your relationship with him?
Very close. There's probably a dozen or so people out there in leadership roles who I have very close relationship. The former head of the Qatar military, Sheikh Hamad, he and I are very close. MBZ and I are very close. Some of the ambassadors here I'm very close to. Former ambassador from Yemen, the ambassador from UAE, he considers me one of his mentors. I got him into National War College and National Defense University when he was young, and he's always felt beholding because of that. A lot of other people out there who are acquaintances, who I don't know directly very well, all know me by reputation, because I've spent, ever since 1990, I've been in this region in one capacity or another. And still, after I retired, on a business or diplomatic missions or at their requests, I've been out there. They asked me to come out. They just started a war college, a national defense college, and they asked me to give the opening session speech on strategy and the role of the U.S. in the region as their first lecturer and to kick off their school, their college. Shows you how they're developing their military, their senior leadership. And, you know, they constantly want me to come out and visit and come out and be with them. And all over. I mean, you know, when Kuwait was trying to mediate the Qatar dispute, I went there to see if I could help them. They said, we would love to have you with it. You know, we'll even support you if they're willing to have you step up as the lead mediator, which is unusual because I was out there to say, we'll support you. Because MBS did not want Americans to solve the problem. That was definitely, it made no bones about that.
Yeah.
This is internal. We should be able to resolve it. We don't want to be seen as somebody has to come in from the outside doing that. I said, look, we're not after recognition of, you know, having solved it or anything else. We just want to help support in any way we can a resolution. And we're fully willing to stay in the background in this thing or play a supporting role. King Abdullah of Jordan, I know him from our military days, and his brothers. You know, the King Abdullah, the former king of Saudi Arabia, I knew very well. King Fahd, the Sultan Qaboos, who just passed away, I knew him very well. And I know the emir and his brother, who's a foreign minister in Qatar, very well. Very close to the king of Bahrain and his son, the crown prince, and the head of their military. You know, so, I mean, General Sisi. I mean, the Egyptian army generals all know me because we had a very close relationship. And the foreign minister, who used to be ambassador to the U.S., who's kind of soured on the U.S., so we have some interesting conversations. The former president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, we were very close, you know.
It's interesting, yeah. So the UAE then is obviously very stable. Trying to influence, trying to be a big player, or is a big player in the region, mm-hmm. and you see that on the ascension?
I think they'll always play a key role because I think partially because obviously their wealth, which is far, far greater than maybe their size, extremely competent military, again, even given their size, a very strong military. Special relationships they built with us and Europe and European powers and several others. I think MBZ, his personality, his leadership role is highly recognized out there. Not yet. You know, like I say, man, I agree with everything he does, but you recognize him as a very strong leader. Maybe the one and only has influence on MBS and others in the region. And it used to be that some of the old emirs receive respect from everybody, like Sheikh Zayed. Everybody loves Sheikh Zayed, you know, in the region. He was seen as a wise, elder statesman. The last one of that ilk is the emir in Kuwait. But some of the young guys are not really, you know, recognizing that role and acknowledging it. I think MBZ still does, but the old guys are going off to leaving the scene now. So it isn't going to be the same kind of, you know, who's the wise old man. When King Abdullah came to Saudi Arabia, he was seen as a reformer. He was not one of the Sederi Seven brothers. He was kept himself from humble backgrounds, not a ostentatious living and that sort of thing. And he was highly respected and seen as a leader. I don't think you see that anymore. I think there's some guys out there that would like to be in that role, maybe MBS. I don't see it happening the same way. Times have changed. The best way you can appeal to the majority of people out there is being a reformer. And that's one of MBZ's strengths. Now, MBS had claimed to do that, and there's been some reforms in Saudi Arabia. It reduced the influence of the religious police, and women can drive now. There's been a lot of changes. But MBZ is, and UAE are far out in front. They've had women ambassadors, women fighter pilots. They've had women ministers in their finance and senior positions. They have modernized and reformed far faster rate than anybody else. Yeah. So I think for young guys, that's going to be the way recognition will go, is seen as, you know, non-corrupt, not looking at living in palaces in isolation, really focused on doing good things with the wealth they have, and really reforming and modernizing their societies. I think that's going to be what will separate them from others and will get recognition.
So I'm curious, because I think I'd read that UAE has, I think, just 1 million citizens.
I don't think it's that much. Maybe it could be. You know, like Qatar has like 300,000. They don't have big populations of citizens. And you can't become a citizen, just, you know, become a citizen. You can certainly work there. One of the things they have started to do, and this goes back to King Abdullah, Saudi Arabia, they're cutting back on expats in leadership roles. You know, the old story was the very wealthy elite, they don't have to do any work. They come in at the top. They're the CEOs and everything else. But they don't really run the business. They don't really work. You bring in a bunch of Brits at the next level of management, and they really run things. And then it even cascaded down to, well, we're not going to have people do menial work. You're not going to flip burgers at McDonald's. We'll bring in the Indians and the Bangladeshis and the Pakistanis to do that. And then they stuck guys at middle management level. But again, they really, you know, they were put in a couple hours a day, went home. And then you found the Brits and the others in there doing that kind of work. Americans started getting in there. But King Abdullah wanted to change all that. And so what you're seeing more and more throughout the region as these reforms follow up, there's more insistence that the locals, the citizens, go to work. So one of the things like MBZ wanted to do was get experience for his young people as interns. One of the companies I'm with, we take two Emiratis a year, and they come into the company as interns to learn business functions, business practices. King Abdullah wanted scholarships at American universities. He wanted 100,000. I think he got up to pretty high, not 100,000, but, you know, tens of thousands of scholarships at American universities. And he started taking away the dole. You're going to earn your money, and you're going to work your way up the ladder. You're not going to just plug in at the top with no experience or no competence. So a lot of that has been part of the reform, too. So limiting expats and beginning to create their own sort of competent cadre of people to run it, ensuring people have to earn the money. You're not going to walk in like your father did and just sit back and collect a big check for nothing.
So I'm curious, is it a solid assumption to say that if you're a Qatar, if UAE has, you know, 1 million people or less, is it easier to reform your country when you have a smaller population?
Small population, a lot of money. Yeah, probably the toughest thing for a place like Saudi Arabia is the influence of the Wahhabis. You know, very conservative religious society by nature. A lot of resistance to some of the reforms, although less than I expected. You know, it's it can only go so far. I mean, you know, Sharia law and all the things that, you know, work against modernization, they've had to be very careful with it. I think sometimes they feel some reforms are too fast or stretched too far. But I got to say, like UAE, they handle it very well. They think through how the reforms are going to be put in place. They pick very competent people to be first ones to do it, you know.
You had mentioned Bahrain. Can you talk about them?
Small country, very dependent on Saudi Arabia, have a minimal amount of resources. Obviously, something like the Sultanate of Oman, it's always been a kingdom. As a matter of fact, the king's father was, he was an emir. Current king decided, no, I'm a king. And I have a legitimate claim to that because it was a kingdom of Bahrain. And so he made himself king. Good to be king, you know. They basically do whichever direction the Saudis go, they go full steam. They make no beans about it. Their biggest problem is internal, very large Shia population that has been, you know, has gone into the streets a couple times and raised hell, and they had a couple tense moments. So, and they realized if that got too bad, they would need external help. Okay, military. I mean, I like their military leadership, but, you know, again, not going to stand independent in any way from Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
It's not the direction they take. And they have the Tree of Life. You ever heard of the Tree of Life?
Tell me.
If you go down If you go down to the bottom end of Bahrain, it's just desert. It's just flat and desert. And in the middle of this desert is this huge tree. It looks like a gigantic oak tree. And no one could figure out where it came from, how old it is, you know, why in the middle of the desert you have this one tree, where does it get its water, anything else. So the claim is this is the tree of life, and that's where the original Garden of Eden was. Huh. And so no one, you know, it is there, and it's interesting and fascinating. But, Turkey claims that Garden of Eden was there, and there are all these claims, but the Garden of Eden supposedly was where the confluence of three rivers came together. And so there's no place they could find in the Middle East where that really fit that. But they realize now from geological analysis and everything, that's about where three rivers met before the Gulf was created and all too. So
interesting.
Who knows?
So it's a solitary tree.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
It's huge too. Yeah. That's a tree of life. Look it up.
Yeah, I will.
Google it. They Bahrain, the tree of life. It's a remarkable thing in the middle of the desert. It's where my camel was.
Well, there must be the tree of life. That's great. That's a great story. Fascinating. So the $64,000 question is, do you ever envision any of these countries becoming democratic?
Yeah. Technically, some of them are, like Iraq and Egypt, you know, not the best forms of democracy, but technically they are. So,
but let's say the Gulf states, you know, UAE, Saudi Arabia, you know.
Not in the short term. First of all, you can't underestimate culture. Culturally, the role of the leader is different than we think, because we get caught up in maybe the last generation, not all of them, that, you know, suddenly discovered oil, were wealthy, and they lived in the palaces, and they enjoyed life, and they had yachts and all, you know, the stereotype of the Arab sheikh, the runner. But their fathers weren't that way. Their fathers were nomadic tribal leaders. And because they're nomadic people, they have a saying out there, if you don't treat us well, you can rule the houses. We're actually tents. Because what the people did is, if this ruler is not treating them well, they just packed up and went to the next emirate where there was a more benevolent, caring leader. And in their culture, the leader is thought of as somebody who has the responsibility to take care of my welfare. And to move away from that, culturally, is a change that's very difficult. You know, I mean, this is not like a czar in Russia or the king in France and, you know, the kind of oppressive leadership from a group of elites, that culturally that had been their experience. These were tribal leaders that shared the same hardships and everything else, that were responsible for caring for their people. And you might say there was a generation after the wealth that maybe didn't appreciate that much, but many of them coming back to that kind of leadership, or at least some form of it, where they do have to respond to the needs of people. The second thing is, especially if you look at the wealthy countries, because of the energy resources and all, why would people try to change something when you're living fat, dumb, and happy? I mean, why do I give a shit who decides what our relationship with the U.S. is going to be? Or, you know, I'm getting mine. I mean, so they're doing well, they're living well, they're being taken care of. Why do you want to change it? You know, so that's another factor. Not every place, because some of these places don't have those resources. Right. Strangely enough, the seven monarchies survived the best out of the Arab Spring. They were the most stable. You know, it's the GCC countries plus Jordan plus Morocco. You know, the seven monarchies, that there was the least amount of, I need to change the government in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them have gone to reforms like Kuwait did, where the parliament's elected. I mean, the emir doesn't appoint the parliament. They're elected. He made the chief of the military have to defend his budget before parliament. Parliament approved it. Wasn't his. I remember when it happened, though, General Ali, who was the commander, he came to me and said, you got to teach me how to present my budget and defend it. He says, it used to be, I just went to the emir, he signed off on it. Now I got to go to parliament. like you guys do to Congress and defend it. I said, good luck.
That's interesting. So just to take your friend MBZ, he's about, I think he's like 58 or 59 around that age.
Yeah.
Okay. Is he training? I assume he has sons and daughters. Mm-hmm. Is he training his sons to take up after him the leadership role?
Yes, but not only his family. He is also very much into, he really looks for very smart people, very energetic, a lot of leadership skills, and he tries to get them as much. Yusuf Otebo, who's the ambassador to the U.S., when I was CENTCOM commander, MBZ came to me and said, I have a favor. I have a young guy. He's in his 20s. I want to send him to the National Defense University. He said he's not a military, senior military officer. He's not a senior diplomat, so he wouldn't normally qualify. He says, this guy you're going to hear from in the future, I would like you to make an exception. I went to Secretary Cohen. Cohen said, let's do it. The NDU wasn't really thrilled. He went there. He set the place on fire. He was such a brilliant guy and everything. And when he brought him back, he became his national security advisor. Then he made him ambassador to the United States. He's like the senior of the diplomatic corps here. Still a young guy, but... Okay. You know, ball of fire, educated at Georgetown, you know, went to the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, and we had that, which is a school we thought would be best for his equipment to our, you know, war college level mm-hmm. and senior.
Interesting. So it's...
He's not a royal.
Okay.
You know, so it's not like he was family guys only.
So you're saying he's, right now, he's mentoring other people other than his own family.
He looks for talent, and he tries to get them the skills and develop in the right way. His daughters do remarkable work. They had some of the government organizations and largest charitable organizations. His daughters are very, very skilled.
So if democracy was ever going to come to UAE, I mean, how would you see that happening?
No, I don't. I can't imagine because it's small.
Yeah.
First of all, it's seven emirates. It's not, you know, and they each have their own emir. I don't see what would drive it, you know. I mean, look, we wouldn't have shucked off the British control if they'd have treated us fairly, if we had representatives in Parliament and we weren't unfairly taxed. In some cases, taxed like the British felt like if I've got to have soldiers over there protecting you from the Indians and everything else, you got to help pay for it. And, you know, we'll do our own, which is okay, but... Unless people begin to feel they're not being represented or taken care of, but I don't see how that would happen. You know, it's small population. Right. You know all the families. You know everybody, you know around. It's you could drive from one end of the emirate to the other in hours. I mean, it's not the United States of America. It's not the Soviet Union, right. Russia.
I wanted to ask you about going over all these countries in terms of Afghanistan. And we've talked about that in the past, but tell me where you see Afghanistan now and what's the future lie for Afghanistan?
Well, Afghanistan is not going to become, you know, a Jeffersonian democracy or a free market economy. It's a 11th century society. A lot of poverty. People live in mud huts in the middle of nowhere. There's no real education system or anything else. So probably going to see when we leave that the Taliban and the old Northern Alliance of the people we have in there now, governance, will go at it again. And probably you're going to see the Taliban and others, the more very conservative, religiously and otherwise, in the hinterlands and maybe around the Ring Road, and it'll be call itself a democracy. But... You know, I don't think it's going to look anything like democracies in Europe or wherever. It's tribal. You know, no one gives a shit whether you're a Taliban or they care whether you're a Pashtun or a Tajik. You know, I mean, and the British, when they carved up the empire, they drew border lines right through tribal areas. I mean, that is more powerful identity than anything else. And I don't see it as becoming a cohesive, you know, national entity. There is potential there. I mean, I understand there's a lot of mineral resources and everything, but there's no infrastructure to exploit it and to process it in some way. So, you know, I think it's going to be fairly primitive for a while. When Osama bin Laden left with Al-Qaeda and beat feet to Pakistan, we should have pulled out. With the understanding, we'll come back if you guys come back and try to kill you. And let them to their own devices. If they want to go out and kill each other, let them kill each other. Basically, most of them want to be left alone. They just want to stay in their valley and grow poppy seeds and, you know, raise sheep, and that's it. And what are we trying to do there? I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just a drain on our treasure and our casualties and everything else. You know, we can't help ourselves. I mean, we can't just go in and say there's a bad guy there who did us wrong. We're going to go in and get the bad guy and get rid of the problem and then come home. We just don't do that last one. You know, we somehow have to turn you into a shiny image of us. And, you know, my son told me the story when he was, you know, when they went into this one village in Marja in that area, and the chief came out to see him. Of course, you know, Marines had interpreters. And the chief said, "Who are you, Russians?" And my son said, "No, we're Americans." Chief said, "Oh, you were here in 1952. You built the irrigation system." He said, "Did you come back to fix it?" Yeah. "Oh, no, we came back to give you Jeffersonian democracy, free market economy." Translate that into Pashto, you know.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, I guess we do have this idea that said if you're living in a mud hut or a straw hut, that something's got to be wrong, right?
You know, when I was in Somalia, I came to the conclusion that we should have let General Adid run the country. You know, he kept telling me, he would say to me, "Look, Sinny, you don't understand. I can run this country. Look at those other 13 warlords, you know," and they were just warlords. And I'd go to his hideout or his compound, walk into his office. He had books on the shelves. He had pens and pads with his logos on them. He had his cabinet members. He was organized. You know, he was a real general, and he was an ambassador and cabinet member in the CIA Barry. And I thought, he's the only guy that could administrate this country. Now, in the long term, maybe that's not going to work out. But right now, it's a shithole, you know? And so, as the president would say, right now he's the best they got to pull it together. Not the long-term solution, but maybe right now that's what they need.
Yeah. We were talking earlier, and we were talking about why should Americans or anyone care about the Middle East? And you said something very fascinating about the exodus of people leaving the Middle East, going to predominantly, you know, to Europe, and what a impact that is having. Do you see, again, as Americans, we're not Europeans, so should we really care about that? And what do you see if this problem continues? What kind of impact is that going to have on Europe?
Well,
and the Middle East.
One thing we have to realize: if you look at first world countries, any destabilization of first world countries, you know, first, second, third world countries, will impact the global economic system. And will, you know, look, remember when Greece was falling apart?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the question would be, who gives a shit about Greece? So let them come apart. But no, I mean, the European Union, that could, Germany, and they put a lot of money into saving Greece. As Greece began to wobble, our stock market was wavering. If France and Belgium and these countries get overwhelmed with immigrants and it changes their identity, it taxes their economy, and they slip from first world to second or third world, that's not good for the global system. Also, look at the global issues we have, like climate change. You need fairly responsible first world countries that have the resources to invest in solving problems like climate change. If they degrade, they're going to have other priorities. If their societies begin to collapse, they don't have the infrastructure, we could have pandemics, you know, and they're not able to cope with diseases and everything, and that begins to move around. I mean, you can see all kinds of cities no longer can function properly. And then when they break down, where are those people going to go? They're going to go somewhere else. And so you got to fix problems where they are. I just signed on as a member of the President's Council, not the President of the United States, the President's Council of the Alliance for Peace Building. And they lobbied very heavily, a lot of former diplomats, NGOs, they lobbied very heavily in Congress and actually pulled off getting past the Global Fragility Act, which means we need to set aside funds, which Congress did, to invest in countries that are showing signs of coming apart. I would have never thought they could get it through Congress. Congress hates foreign aid and all that stuff. But the people beginning to realize that all those chickens come home to roost. That you don't have two mighty oceans and borders and mountain ranges and everything to say that problem can't come to me. The world is globalized in so many different ways. And our global environment is being overtaxed. And so it affects us globally, at least. And your ability to deal with it, you better worry about the middle class of the world suddenly degenerating into poverty levels, not just here, but elsewhere in the world. So, you know, if we don't have a strong network of first world countries and helping other countries move into that level, we're going to see a general global deterioration, not just economies, but environment and health conditions and social order. I mean, that's will all follow. You know, one thing that probably if I had is if you ask me, tell me the one thing you've learned after, you know, being all around the world and been in some real crazy thing places. How fragile civilization is. I mean, we think we're civilized. I mean, we could never deteriorate to being uncivil, chaos in the streets, poverty levels, violence and all this stuff. I've seen societies that just like that, it broke and they just turned into mobs and chaos and anarchy. I think it's a lot more difficult for us, but you don't underestimate the ability to do that.
Thank you for joining us. Find us on Facebook at General Zinni APW and online at apkcg.com/APW. I'm Adam P. Kennedy, and this is America's Place in the World.